It's silly, it's goofy, it's even stupid in a brilliant sort of way, and it's just been nominated for a Tony, the Broadway play, The Play What I Wrote. It stars the British comedy duo The Right Size, made up of my guests, Sean Foley and Hamish McCall. They sing, they dance, they fall down, they do heart-stoppingly bad jokes, classic slapstick, and musical skits, all without a trace of irony. Oh yes, and then there's the plot. Foley and McCall play a comedy team in crisis. Hamish believes he's a serious playwright and wants to leave the double act. Sean, the rubber-legged funny man, wants to keep the act going. With the help of his sidekick, Arthur, Sean humors Hamish into believing they will indeed stage his awful play, set during the French Revolution. This provides the opportunity for the show's hook. Each evening, a mystery guest celebrity takes a role in the Bastille scene of the play within a play. Guests have included Nathan Lane, Glenn Close, Kevin Klein, and Roger Moore. The play What I Wrote is inspired by a legendary British double act, Eric Morecambe and Ernie Wise, who hosted TV variety shows in the 60s and 70s, watched by everyone from bus drivers to the Windsors. Just to emphasize how hard it is to nail down the style of this show, it's been nominated for a Tony in the category of Best Special Theatrical Event. I'd like to talk about language, and I have to admit I have all these notes from the play about puns, but I can't read anything I wrote. I think I was laughing too hard. And also, the play moves along so quickly, I never finished anything. The only line that survived is one that I believe Hamish says. It's in the dreadful play within a play, his serious play, A Tight Squeeze for the Scarlet Pimple, which takes place, of course, during the French Revolution. And Hamish, you're draped in a French flag, and you're wearing a tiny Eiffel Tower on your head, and you say, now, if I say it, it's not going to be funny. I know.
Don't ask me to say it. I don't get funny until 8 p.m. every evening.
You say, I am France, and parts of me are revolting. I can't bear it.
Yeah.
No.
Discuss.
Discuss with reference to the French Revolution. Well, it was actually first said by Marat when Charlotte Corday wouldn't pass him the soap.
I have no question about this. No, what process do you go through in writing to come up with puns like that? Is that a line that you had to hone or revise, or did you add the camembert part later as you were goofing around?
That line came about, yes, that was actually one of the sections that was slightly tweaked for the New York show. So that wasn't, the Hamish with his flag and his Eiffel Tower wasn't in the London show. But yes, in answer to where did we make that material, we made it up in the Manhattan Theatre Club when we were goofing around trying to find what we needed. And believe me, there were other gags suggested and probably tried, and those were the ones that were the best, and they honed well and they sit well with the audience, and they are as absurd as they are. They are awful lines, and they're the permanent excuse and deflating point for the audience is that this is you're allowed to do bad jokes because they are written by a man who thinks he is brilliant. Hamish the playwright is the worst writer who has ever lived, and he has written these absurdly bad lines, and you know, that gives a certain license for you to do them. If you really were doing them utterly straight up an evening of that, then I think you might have a harder time. But there is a sort of perspective in the story, which is that this one character really is not blessed with any writing skill at all.
So you kind of come in through the back door there. And then,
well, at the same time as you may well be inclined to laugh at silly and stupid jokes like that, you're also very much more inclined to laugh at a person, a character, who believes that what they're doing is wonderful and great, and that they are the new Arthur Miller light, and which Hamish does, and it's therefore you're laughing at the character as well as the joke, and that's always a much stronger laugh, I think, to get, and that's, you know, that brings us back to the show. I mean, all sorts of comedy is employed, and as you say, there's slapstick, there's physical comedy, there's visual and verbal puns, there's comedy with the set, but underneath it all is in fact a story going on, that you're watching a story which sustains, we think anyway, that amount of sort of frothy comedy is sustained by the fact that actually you are watching in process a little conflict going on, a drama, a story of these two guys, and will they patch it up and keep working together, or will indeed Hamish leave to become this great writer, as he thinks?
Now, there's also a bit, a good deal of the play is a reference to comedy, and there is a scene where you, Sean, are trying to console Hamish about his ability or his lack of ability to get laughs, and you talk about the delayed laugh and the anticipatory laugh, and the most sophisticated laugh of all, the inaudible laugh. Now, those first two laughs really, I don't know about the inaudible one, but they do exist. I mean, doing what you do, you must have a whole category, a slew of categories for different kinds of laughs. Is that true?
Well, we do. I mean, but those are taken to extremes. The delayed laugh. Hamish's character says, you know, that he doesn't understand how when he says something, nobody laughs, and then Sean says something, and everybody laughs. And that it is described to him that that is the delayed laugh, because people what I say is so funny that people go into shock and that they aren't able to laugh until actually after it's till Sean says something. Indeed, you know, those are absurd ones, but we are, precise, I think I'd say. Not so much in terms of the kind of laughs, but how to get them. I mean, we have Ken Branagh, who directed this show, who we hadn't known before, and when he came into rehearsals was amazed and never ceased to tease us about the language with it, which we use for... How to best affect a laugh in the audience. We're constantly talking about things like holding it up, which means that if you go at it, holding it up for us means that you you're going for the punchline, but you can't put the punchline too quickly in. So you might put a phrase like "by the way" or
well anyway,
which would just hold it up and then you deliver the punchline, because the analysis would be that without that, the punchline comes too quick and you're not getting the best of the laugh. The other one would be like, we call it like studying it, which means that if you're aiming at a punchline in three lines time, is it just how many times do we share the preceding lines before we go for the punchline? And a line is a stud. So Sean might say to me, for this line, I need you to stud me there, which would mean...
You could just say something as simple as what, or
yeah.
You say when, or whatever it is. It's just, as Hamish says, it's literally the science of when you are delivering the thing at which you want everyone to laugh, to get the most effect from your material.
So it might be highly efficient, for example, not to get the audience laughing for during a build. A rhythmical build, because then when you do release the laughter, you get a much bigger laugh at the end. Whereas if they've laughed sort of consistently and irregularly throughout the build, your punchline laugh will never be as big. I can just hear how obsessive this thing is.
I can hear people falling asleep.
wake up, America.
Wake up, everyone.
Wake up, America.
It is interesting, but only to a very, very few people.
Ronnie Corbett, as a great English comedian, said, "You talk about comedy at your peril, because the minute you do it, it starts to unravel in your hands." And I think it's a mercurial thing. It doesn't really make much sense to talk about it in any really empirical sense. It's intuitive, really.
Well, moving on, every performance features a mystery guest who agrees to perform in Hamish's overwritten and overacted play and perform in period costume. Were the mystery guests part of this old variety show format?
Is that how you came upon that?
They're
exactly right. They Morecambe and Wise in their television series, they would have a mystery guest, you know, every week, and they would be, because they were such huge British TV stars then at that point, they would get people like truly great actors, like, you know, Laurence Olivier would come on and be, I think you say it here, sort of lightly roasted, you know, teased to within an inch of his life about how bad he was as an actor and, you know, why couldn't he deliver these great lines better than what he was doing. You know, they even had... our Prime Minister at the time, Harold Wilson, on one of their shows. So they were that big. But that is where the idea comes from, that the guest star would, as happens in our show, the guest star turns up desperately. Sean has promised Hamish that you know, to try and keep the evening going, because he doesn't want Hamish to leave, he said that he will do his play, and that, indeed, there is a guest star turning up to do it, when he knows full well that there isn't in his mind. But then, miraculously, you know, Liam Neeson will turn up, or Nathan Lane will turn up, or Glenn Close will turn up, or Jeff Goldblum will turn up, all people we've had in the show so far, amongst others, and John Lithgow has done it as well, and they will turn up to be to take their role as the Count de Toblerone in Hamish's French Revolution masterpiece, A Tight Squeeze for the Scarlet Pimple.
Well, what are some of the roasting or teasing of prominent guest stars that you're most proud of?
We adored teasing Sting when he did it. He had a line which we asked him to say, that he was delighted to be there, but would we please not take the Mickey out of any of his song lyrics, which we then peppered the entire show with. Of course, it was constantly stop the show, there's a message for you, Sting, it's in a bottle. There was all every little thing you're doing is magic.
Don't stand so close to me, Sting.
And it was that was just wonderful. But in general, everywhere, I mean, Liam Neeson, Sean thinks for the entire length of the play is Leslie Nielsen. You know, they're sort of absurdly light, but they're extremely efficient ways of teasing people. And I think that it's got an enormous comic richness to it.
Now, Kenneth Branagh, your director, he was also a mystery guest one night. How did he do?
He did very well, except he did forget his very first line, which is when he comes on, he has to say his first line is, "I am Ken Branagh." due to large amounts of nerves and a certain sense of surreal that he was in the show that he had been directing, that was something that we were able to tease him about for months. But he did very well. He's quite a good actor, actually.
Who would have guessed?
He did not too bad, not too bad. People not were quite bad. Pleased to see him on stage, yeah.
How did you two meet?
We met, romantically enough, in Paris in 1986, I think, or 7, where we were both studying at a theatre school run by a man called Philippe Gaulier. And we were there for the long and rich period of 1 month before we ran out of money. And we came back to England together. And during that time of that, in Paris, we had made each other laugh and we had improvised really well on stage together. And we thought, yeah, let's start doing work. So we started doing cabarets and hat fairs and summer fairs and anything, and, you know, just comic shtick, really. And then after that, we developed a fully fledged company. In 1988, we made our first show, Caesar Art. And we've been touring the world with the shows like that, and very much comedy theatre shows, for the last 15 years.
You did tour all over the world. I think I read you were in Oman for a performance.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Were there cultural differences in? I mean, was that a memorable performance? Your gig?
Oman, it was an extremely successful evening, but it was, yeah, very, very different. I mean, but they're extremely cultured people, and they very much enjoy laughing. So it was great. I mean, we've played in places where, like in West Africa, when we played there, we played in Ghana and places like that. And even when we played in Oman, actually, when we played outside the central, the main city, the biggest difference is that they don't have a strong sense of the delineation between audience and performer. So you have a lot of interaction with people calling out to you, or maybe even coming to visit you on stage. It's a much more movable.
There's no history of theatre in that sense of. There's a stage and we go in and we pay the money and we sit down and just we take what they give us on stage. That it was sort of like we're all in this big room together, you know. Why don't we just all do what everyone else does, you know?
Yeah.
And so and the things the that we were doing a show called Flight to Finland, which was all set on a boat, and every time we'd sort of try and portray or imagine that, or suggest that there were seagulls overhead, people would really, really react like there were seagulls overhead, or they'd really react like...
And create their own seagulls in you know, or they'd wave... Sean would wave out at some as the ship left an imaginary port, and everybody would stand up and wave back at him.
So it was a real collaboration.
Because it was just, you know, it's just sort of...
God knows how we haven't got through the show.
Well, I mean, it was just a completely different show, but they had a great time, you know, and it's, I think that one of the sort of things that we learned during that was that, you know, you have to keep very loose and easy on your material and not get uptight about it, because they're doubtlessly having a great time, but just they're not having the time that you would expect them to have, or not in the way that you would expect them to be having it.
Now, did you actually research old routines from vaudeville halls or look up old vaudeville players?
Well, we've come at sort of, you know, getting hold of that material and reinventing it, as it were, from lots of sources. Just simply some, you know, old films you might see, or so, indeed classic films. You know, Buster Keaton is a hero of both of ours. You know, as are Laurel and Hardy and some of the great silent comedians. That's their work is still current and still wonderful. Then you have the more people over here, like you had Bert Lahr, and we had over in Britain, you know, our musical stars, Max Wall, and his sort of array of funny walks comes to mind, which, you know, then in the generation after that was Monty Python and their Ministry of Silly Walks, which was, you know, essentially that old tradition of what was called eccentric dancing put in a new form and a new sketch, and represented as lots of types of comedy are.
Now, tell me if this is too personal, but are either one of you married or in a serious relationship? And
oh,
I ask
gosh,
that.
Barbara, don't ask us that.
Personal.
I mean, that is outrageous.
So I can't believe it. She sounded such a nice lady, didn't she?
And then bang, like that. Grubbing around, trying to get the dirt. Yeah. I'm married, yes, two kids.
Uh-huh. I'm married, yes, one kid.
Well, very good. So I thought that would be such a problem with the double act. That was a classic. Once you get married and other people enter into the mix, were there any bumps?
Well, this is where the people often say that a double act is like a marriage, don't they, Sean?
Yeah, and it's absolutely absurd, isn't it, darling?
I mean, the thing is, we work together, but I mean, many people who, you know, Ben and Jerry make ice cream together. I mean, and I don't know whether they're married, but they presumably have other lives. There's a sort of conception with double acts that you're sort of that you are in some way married or impossibly close. I mean, we work together, we tour together, but we go home, we have other lives. We don't socialise together anymore, because we used to do that a lot in the old days, and we have our families to go home to. You know, it's not that much different than a normal business. We are business partners, and then we have our
You make families. It sound so romantic.
I'm weeping.
Yeah.
Well, Sean Foley and Hamish McCall, I want to thank you very much for allowing me to put you
Enter
through this dissection
world.
Of your comedy.
Yeah. Thank you very much, Barbara, although I'm still smarting about that personal question you asked.
Sean Foley and Hamish McCall star in the Broadway show The Play What I Wrote. It's been nominated for a Tony.